I remember auditioning for a director called Mike Lee. This guy's a hero of mine. I want to be part of whatever it is he's making. I remember going in, sitting with him, lovely man, and went really well. I was in there for about an hour. He said, thank you very much. He walked me to the door. And there's two doors. There's like two identical doors. And I open one of them. And I say, thank you very much. And as I'm still looking at him as I open this door, as I close the door behind me, I hear him say, have fun in there. Have fun in there. I close the door and realize that I've just walked into his broom cupboard and close the door behind me.
Hello, this is your host, Graham Rooney, and welcome to A Performer, A Pint and A Pod. The podcast where I take you down the pub and we meet a performer, have a drink, and find out the tiddly truth. You only get in a pub. I'll be chatting to fantastic performers at all different points of their careers, discussing where they've come from, career-defining moments, and of course, guilty pleasures. All whilst having a laugh and getting a wee bit pissed. Fancy a pint with a pop star? A whiskey with your West End idol? Or a mojito with a magician? Then join me down the pub. So, without further ado, let's head down to the local and see which one of the nation's top performers is in there tonight. Pint, please, mate. Thank you very much. This week, we go for a pint with good mate of mine and top actor, Eamon Elliott. And what a career have we got to catch up on. Because, well, he is smashing it. He's just recently finished starring on Broadway. He's been in Star Wars, Game of Thrones, and Alien prequel, Prometheus. Not to mention playing the lead in a BBC period drama. Talk about nailing your career goals. Anyway, let's get the pint in. Eamon Elliott, hello and welcome to A Performer, A Pint and A Pod. How are you doing, mate?
I'm very well, Mr. Rooney. How are you?
I'm all right, mate. Not too bad at all. What are you drinking?
What am I drinking? I'm having a pint of Camden Hills right now, a very fancy craft lager.
Oh, that's very nice. Very London of you.
Absolutely. London. What about yourself?
A little pint of Cronenberg.
Well, lovely.
Yeah, on a Monday afternoon.
Fizzy. Nice to reconnect with you, mate. It's been a long time.
It has been quite a while. For people listening in, you were in the would never know. You were the year below me. So I graduated 2004 and you were 2005. Now, it's not that we've not spoken since then. I do think we went for, I think the last time I might have seen you, we were absolutely pissed in Edinburgh or something.
God no. Somewhere.
So my recollection of what we talked about, I've not got much idea.
Yeah, as you say, hazy, drunken memories.
Well, I mean, the thing about it is, it just all goes so fast, though. That's the thing. It's very rapid. And also, you've been a very busy man. You're hard to tie down, you know?
Well, I've sometimes I'm busy and sometimes I'm not. I guess, you know, when you're looking at someone else's career and you kind of look at it on paper, it looks like I've been very busy. And that's
that's the wonder of the acting career. It's like oh, wow, no. You've done four jobs in 2010, but it's like, actually, you've worked 4 days in 2010.
Exactly, yeah. I've probably been sitting on my ass as much as I've been on a set or on stage, to be quite fair. I don't want to nullify the point in this podcast. Yes, I've been very busy.
No, it's like people have knocked off already. People have just switched off. I'm like,
what? This guy.
I'm like, I am going to have to edit this out. Right. Okay, Eamon Elliott, now that I've edited it back in, you are a superstar. There we go. Right, back in. No, seriously, mate. You're a fantastic actor, but what I'd like to know, because I mean, I don't really know myself, is kind of how it all began for you. Like, prior to drama school, where did it all sort of kick off?
Well, I left school at 17 and I went to university to study English and French. And the reason I did that was because when I went to speak to my advisor at school about, you know, further education and, you know, where I wanted to be going after sixth year, and suggested that I wanted to become an actor, I was met with sort of a set of rolling eyes. And then basically I was told that that isn't going to happen. You have to go to university. You should follow the yellow brick road so that we can kind of tick the box and say another pupil has gone off to university, rather than, you know, someone spent 6 years at our school and come out of it wanting to be an actor. So I was very much, I was so impressionable and so young at that age that I thought, okay, I'll just go to university. And after about 6 months at Aberdeen University studying English and French, I kind of realized that, you know, essay writing and reading novels back to back wasn't turning me on and wasn't the thing that I wanted to be doing for the rest of my life. So I dropped out. I dropped out after 6 months. I went back to Edinburgh and I told my parents I want to become an actor. And the only school that was still auditioning was RSAMD, or RCS, as it's known these days.
Yes, the Royal Conservatoire for the
very
newbies.
So I auditioned for RSAMD, or the Conservatoire, and luckily I got in. If I didn't audition for any other schools, the reason that I auditioned for that school was because they were the only school still holding auditions. It was quite late in the day, and I don't know what I would have done if I hadn't been accepted. I remember vaguely thinking, I'll go and work on, I'll be like an entertainer on cruise ships, or I'll go and work at Butlins. I just wanted to,
Before I went, I don't know if you know this, but before, the summer before I went to drama school, I turned up with a ridiculous tan because I'd been an entertainer in Mallorca for the whole of the summer for 8 months. So then I turned up and everyone's like, why is this ginger boy with ridiculous tan? But yeah, I was an entertainer. And then between first year and second year, I went back for a couple of months as well.
Again, what were you doing?
I was literally, through the day, I would do some sports, so do some volleyball, football and stuff like that. And then in the evening, musicals, things like Grease. I mean, we had this Millennium show, which was basically songs from all the musicals and stuff like that as well. And we did comedy nights and things. It was just a load of fun, load of nonsense. You just did it on the hotel stage sort of thing. But it was great. I mean, I was 18. I was just living my life.
Right. I mean, that was my plan B. It sounds like we got into this in a more similar way than we had imagined. Because if you were being an entertainer and singing and dancing and kind of finding acting and performance through musicals, that's what happened to me. Because in school, that was all that was on offer.
It is very much so. Aye. I think, yeah. Where are you from exactly again?
From Portobello in Edinburgh, so from the east coast of Edinburgh.
Well, I think that's it. I think, I remember the first sort of shows I was doing was like The King and I and The Sound of Music, and I don't think they had any other scripts. There was only about five went around Scotland.
Aye. but it was the same for me, and it was like this. I remember even before drama school thinking acting is singing and dancing and entertaining.
Yeah, I was very much the same.
Aye, and that's the reason why I got into it, because that's what I love doing and that's what people told me I could do at school. And it wasn't until, you know, first year at the Royal Scottish, where they're sort of throwing Stanislavski at you and Uta Hagen and like genuine methods of how to approach this draft, I thought, wait a minute.
What's going on here?
Yeah, so it was a shock to the system, and that was probably why I was such a terrible actor for that first year, because I really didn't know what I had let myself in for. And it really did, it took a couple of years to readjust and to sort of start looking at this this career and this pursuit of a craft as something that wasn't just entertainment and singing and dancing.
Well, I think that's what's great about that. And I've always said what's great for me, like, because a lot of people are not sure if drama school was the right thing for them or they didn't. Whereas for me, I was like, what I came into drama school as and what I left as is so different, because I had a much different perspective on acting. You know, I was like, walked in as this boy with a Celtic flaming top on, singing like Sandy from Greece and stuff like that. I'm like, you know, but left actually knowing what acting was.
Yeah, I feel the same way. And, I, you know, thank the Royal Scottish for that. But I did feel completely transformed, and my expectations were certainly met with something very different. Because yeah, it was, you know, I sort of went in as this starry-eyed wannabe entertainer. sort of singing and dancing and entertaining, and came out as this sort of holding my furrowed brow with you know, a book of with Stanislavski in one hand, and this idea of this craft in the other. So it almost happened, I guess you and I both became actors by default, but happily so.
Yeah, no, I came in thinking I just love entertaining. That was my thought, rather than acting. I want to be an actor. It was like, I love entertaining, and acting seemed to be the thing. Acting schools were the thing. Do you think that you're still, do you still have that sort of in you? Do you think that you've very much gone way more sort of a serious actor now, or do you still have part of you has that bit of an entertainer in you, and it's a mould of the two?
I think that's a good way of putting it, a mould of the two. I think that sort of that need or that desire to entertain is always at the core of like everything that I do, and I think it is one way of looking at it. No matter how serious the project is, how serious the role or the script, it's essentially entertainment. And, you know, that's, as I say, that's one way of looking at it. And the other way of looking at it is that it's sort of more about the artist himself, and about it being a craft, and about constantly trying to get better and digging deeper. But I think generally you're performing for the audience rather than for yourself. So I think it'll always be a form of entertainment, and to see it as anything else probably just sounds a little bit pretentious.
Honestly, mate, I'd like, this is brilliant. I didn't think this is a great conversation, because this is exactly what I always think that it is. And you've got to, like, no matter what it can be the most deep emotional thing, and of course, like, you've got to move the audience, and you're telling a story. But my passion in it comes from entertaining. So, like, it has to be a great story for people. And if there isn't entertainment, or it becomes indulgent on stage, which can happen, for definite, then that's where, like, you know, it's gone wrong for me.
Yeah, totally, absolutely.
Well, I think that shows in your CV, though, as well. The fact that you have this kind of probably makes a bit of sense now, because, like, I was looking through it all and I was like, man, some very serious stuff, but real, like, entertaining stuff as well. Yeah. I mean, you've done film, TV, theatre. A lot of the time in this industry, you kind of end up down one path, one avenue, you know, like, you can either end up in TV, film, or whatever one it is, you end up very much on that, and also either drama or comedy as well.
Yeah, I know.
But not you.
I'm not sure how I've managed to slip through the cracks on that one. Honestly, I don't know how to explain that, but it's a position that I'm very happy to be in. I mean, there's been no planning around that at all. I'm just like every other actor in the sense that I take what I'm given, I take what's on offer, if there's anything on offer at all, and I just try and make the best of the opportunities that have come my way. But I don't find, at no point have I thought, oh, I've been doing too much drama, I should think about doing comedy. It's just sort of worked out like this. And you're probably better off asking casting directors or even my agent as to why I've been lucky enough to do a bit of this and a bit of that, and have yet to be pigeonholed. But for me, I just take the work as it comes.
Oh, well, I mean, there's not much point speaking to you then, really, is there? I'm like, oh, well, if he's not going to answer any questions, then I'll just give Ruth a phone, shall I?
I guess it's just an openness to material then, if I'm really having to be more specific about this range of work that I've done. It's just an openness, I guess, to whatever lands on my desk. And I'm lucky enough to have a great agent. And without a decent representative in this industry, it just becomes more of a struggle. I was lucky enough to sign with the agent of my dreams right off the back of drama school, who I'm still with today. And I guess she's been fundamental in making... I remember when I first signed with her, she said, you know, she takes on actors, you know, she's not looking for people who are going to shoot to the top straight away. She's in it to build a career. She likes to actors who do theatre, film and television, almost on, like round the clock, almost on rotation, almost. So I've always, like, maybe it was instilled in me from early on that it's important not to pigeonhole yourself, to always be available to as a theatre actor, as a film actor, and as a TV actor. So I guess my agent's advice early on might have something to do with the fact that I've been open to working on any platform. I mean, and I've been lucky enough to have those opportunities as well.
Well, I think that's the thing. I think, like you say, agents help to shape your career. Obviously, you get the parts and stuff, but Right. They're the ones they put you up for stuff. They're the ones that get the parts coming through. Mm-hmm. And she's obviously aware that, like, she wanted you to be, like, in brilliant theatre, brilliant TV and film and stuff like that. Mm. I think also part of it possibly is how you sort of started out, because you obviously quite early on in your career, you straight away you were in a big theatre hit, weren't you, in Blackwatch?
That's right, Blackwatch. Which I think to this day is one of the most incredible sort of live experiences of my life. I remember when we were doing that, it was like a bunch of 10 young guys doing this show. We went to the Edinburgh Festival to do it. We, as a fringe show, it was supposed to be on for a month in this sort of disused drill hall, and we thought that was that. And in rehearsal, it was very much kind of patched together at the last moment. And I remember sitting with Brian Ferguson, who played Cammy in the original version of Blackwatch, the night before we opened, thinking, what have we let ourselves in for? This is a disaster. Is there any way out of this?
This is the end of all of our careers before it's began.
Honestly, sitting there thinking, this is awful. Why did we agree to do this?
I'm going to be in Butlins after all.
And just having no sense of how it was going to be received. So we went on the next night and it became this immediate hit. And we got to tour around the world with it for almost 3 years. But I remember older actors telling us on tour, like, you will never have this experience ever again on stage. Like, this never happens. This is a once-in-a-lifetime thing where you do a play and it gets that level of response. And we kind of shrugged it off. I was like, this is my second job, mate. Every play I do is going to be like this. But they were absolutely right. And I've never experienced that before. And I guess that's, I don't know what, there must have been some sort of magic in that rehearsal room. But that's, you know, testament to,
but like you say, I mean, it was the National Theatre of Scotland, which pretty much just started, and when we were graduating, and it was its first sort of, like, it was its first huge hit, and it just exploded around, like you say, not just in Scotland but around the world. It won awards everywhere, and there's been, I think, what was there been five recasts now or something?
Yeah, I mean, it's been revamped a couple of times, and we all kind of, after 3 years, I think they realised that we were a little bit broken and getting a little bit too old to play these young squaddies. But yeah, they kind of revamped it with Jack Loudon as the lead, and then I think Ryan Fletcher came in for a bit, and yeah, there's been several versions of it, and I think they've pretty much toured the entire planet. But what that show did was, I mean, people still talk about it today. They still mention it in audition rooms, and especially in auditions for plays. But it just became, I think, being part of something like that just fills you with confidence and also kind of sets the bar in terms of what theatre can be. So coming out of that felt like, you know, it just felt like you'd been a part of something that was sort of the pinnacle of what everyone hopes a theatrical experience can be. And I find myself still chasing that today. And I'll probably never, ever find it again because of the age I was at that time and because of the nature of Blackwatch itself. But it definitely set the bar.
Well, I think that's the thing. I think when you have a theatre experience, like you say, your age, like you, it was your first big theatre job, and it just all of those components together. And then when you add a world tour onto that, I mean, I did a tour recently, and it was a fantastic show. And that's the best experience I've had. It was such a great cast, and the show was a massive hit. And when you're in a show that's a massive hit, the brilliant thing as well is that all the audiences are on your side as soon as you're on stage. It's just like everyone's there just going, this is brilliant, we love it. And it's that, it just breeds confidence.
Absolutely. And it means that you can, you know, I think if Black Witch hadn't got a great response, and I'd had to do it for 3 years, and it was in one venue, we would have just driven each other crazy. And I think going on stage, kind of knowing that what you're about to do is going to affect the audience like deeply and emotionally, means that you can just do it over and over and over again. But I think without that response, and that's the wonderful thing about theatre, without that interaction, the play just falls flat on its face. And I think that's still part of the reason why theatre is my favourite medium, or like my favourite, you know, I much prefer being on stage in front of an audience than I do on a film set, because of that sort of exchange, that interaction of communication and feeling. And there's something magic about that. And I really, the first time I was really exposed to that was in this miraculous show that was Black Watch.
And you're right. There is like an amazing buzz with theatre. I think that most actors would say that theatre is amazing. Especially, when it's at its best. We were talking just before we actually started the podcast about, like, you know, when you've done your shows and there's only 5 people in the audience and they all hate you. It's a bit different.
That's a little bit different, yeah. I mean, soul destroying comes to mind. but it's that risk that you take, you know, every time you go into rehearsal. It's like, this could be the best experience of my career, or it could be absolutely mortifying. And I've been on the other end of it too, as I'm sure most actors out there have as well.
And it's, oh, yes. The worst. Have you ever had a stinker of a review at all?
I have. I mean, I've had a few.
Oh, God. Tell us your stinker.
My stinker, I mean, the one that comes to mind, I was playing a Frenchman on the West End, and it was tough. I'd kind of come in. The show had been on before. The guy who played my part went on to do something else, so I stepped in, and it's in this like third version of this play on the West End. It was a play called Red Velvet. You can look up the review. And it was a Guardian review, which makes this even worse, because a lot of the time that's the review, right? And I remember it said something like there was some dreadful cases of overacting in this production. And then it said, - the worst offender being Emon Elliott. And I read that review. Basically, this very seasoned, experienced reviewer, who's usually very nice, saying that I was overacting. And not only was I overacting, but I was the main culprit. And after reading that, every time, it just completely affected everything I did from then on. Every time I walked on stage, right before I made my entrance, the worst offender, or the main offender, would just, that sentence would just sort of run through my psyche. And you'd think that from that point on, I would have thought, right, I'm never going to read a review ever again. But I'm still reading them. I still
you love it. Masochist.
And then I read the bad ones and think, no, I'm not. I'm awful. And it's just a really difficult thing to do. Don't read your reviews. But it's just, I find that a struggle. And it always bites me in the arse because, you know, this is a cliche, but it just takes, you know, don't read the good ones, don't read the bad ones. Because if you believe the good ones, you should believe the bad ones. But I would say that if you can avoid it, do not read reviews, because that sentence, the worst offender, still sort of plays on repeat and plays with my insecurities all the time. Actors are insecure, me included. Don't read your reviews.
Oh, mate. I mean, that is the thing. That's why I always ask about worst reviews and stuff like that, because people do get so affected by it. And a lot of the time, I mean, it can be what the amazing thing is. I've spoken to people where they've had, 10 5-star reviews saying that they're the greatest thing ever. And then they've got 1 2-star that says, they were absolutely pants. And they just come up going, can't believe it, they said it was absolutely pants. And I'm like, whoa, who said that? I've just read all of these. But it is, because it's really tough, because at the end of the day, like you say, it's this person's opinion. Someone's come and seen it, and that is what they've seen. And it's difficult to shake. However, it's utter bollocks, mate, because I've seen you act.
Thank you.
You're a phenomenal actor, and it shows by what you've done throughout your whole career. And I believe you got an award, didn't you, at the Royal Conservatoire?
They gave me the gold medal, which
basically says you're the best actor in the year.
You stand
in a little podium and listen to the national anthem.
I do remember they used to say that was it was cursed. So whoever had received that gold medal, I think, years previous to me graduating, hadn't worked, or they couldn't get an agent.
That's right.
The gold medal. After I got that, I remember being absolutely baffled on many fronts. One, because how can you say this person's the best? Like, according to who? Russell Boyce? what was his name?
That's the head of drama at RSAMD at the time. Because not everyone will know Russell Boyce.
Russell Boyce, who's the head of drama, that's right. I remember him telling me, Eamon, you got gold. And it's like as if I'd won a race. But also, I didn't deserve that accolade at all. I was the guy who couldn't get to grips with Stanislavski in first year, and who would come in late for classes, and who was too shy to contribute to round-the-table discussions and rehearsal. So it was a real surprise and something that I take with a massive pinch of salt. And as I say, the curse of the gold medal. I'm just lucky that I got an agent and worked, because I thought that was the end of it. The minute they put that medal around my neck, mate, I thought that this is it.
It's a strange one. You are deserving if you get it. But like you say, it's a bit of a strange one, because it does seem like a bit like, how could you... It's not like a race. You can't really equate in the same way.
No.
But, hey, Risha, think of the gold medal rather than the over-actor when you step onto the stage.
All right. Should I wear this thing to auditions? What? Do this thing. How can it serve me? Very grateful. Very grateful.
Please do wear it to an audition. I love the idea. You wearing a medal into an edition.
I can act.
Anyway, let's get back to your career. So you had Black Watch was an amazing hit, and obviously you've said that you struggled with that review and stuff. But was that review before or after you did View from a Bridge at the Young Vic? Is that right?
That's right. That review was after. So I think Red Velvet was after View from the Bridge. And View from the Bridge, again, probably the closest, I'd say after Blackwatch, the closest I got to that level of audience response. And I mean, what an amazing, I don't know if you saw it, I went to see it the other day actually, we're screening it, they did an NT Live of it when we were on the West End, and they screened it at a local cinema the other day. So I went to see it for the first time. And usually theatre on film, it's always a bit sketchy and doesn't really translate. But the way that they shot that, I felt really captured the live experience of what that was. And just to do that play, to do an Arthur Miller play with Ivo van Hove, who's like the rock star of European, global theatre directors at the moment. I mean, he's right at the top. To work with him, to work with Mark Strong, this incredible film actor who hadn't done a play for 15 years, was making his return to the stage with this monster of a part in Eddie Carbone. To do that was just a job that I wasn't able to turn down. I remember being really surprised that I was cast as Marco, because Marco's described as this sort of bullish, strong, of invincible rock of a man. And you know me, Graham, I'm just a wee guy. It's like, I'm really going to have to bulk up for this. Really surprised that I was cast in the first place. But again, yeah, what a phenomenal experience and what a massive challenge that was. I remember the emotional investment that was required to just get through that play was just earth-shatteringly difficult to access, and just having to do that over and over and over again and then realize that you were capable of doing that was really empowering, a really empowering thing to be part of.
That's amazing. Like, honestly, that's brilliant, mate. I mean, unfortunately, I never got to see it, which because, I mean, it's hard to keep up with you, mate. I've got to have a life myself, you know. I can't just come and see everything you do.
On NT Live, I think they'll be screening it again and again and again. So if you get the chance, check it out.
Mate. I mean, with coronavirus, I mean, I can catch up now. Like, you know, I'm catching up in everyone's career. So thanks. I'll put that to the list. Right. But like, looking at your theatre career, like you said, so Black Watch, you've had this amazing hit all around the world and everything that. You've already said that you did the West End. Okay, The Guardian wasn't a big fan. You've done The Young Vic. That's been a National Theatre live production as well. And if I'm right, did you just finish over in Broadway, The Rose Tattoo? Is that
That's right. Another American play, Tennessee Williams play. It was my Broadway debut. And yeah, I finished that just before the new year. That's pretty much the last thing I did. because this year has been so quiet and strange and non-existent in terms of acting. But yeah, finished that sort of four-month run last year. And the way that job came about, again, was this weird moment of serendipity. It just sort of came out of nowhere. I mean, it's not very often you get asked to audition for a play that's gone straight onto Broadway. Usually, you know, that play started off Broadway, or it's a British production that you've been part of, and then it extends and moves over to Broadway. But to be asked to be part of this thing was very strange. And it's to play an Italian in New York. And I remember thinking, why are they coming to London to look for an Italian who can play on Broadway? I mean, New York's full of Italians, full of Italian actors.
And I still heard your wonderful French performance. And they thought, like, there's only one man for it.
Who knows? I mean, I have a feeling the casting director, Jim Carnahan, who casts a lot of Broadway shows, saw View from the Bridge. And in View from the Bridge, I played an Italian. And maybe he saw that and thought, ask him to audition. I'm not sure. But I met with the director. I read, I think, half the play in this sort of cod Italian accent that I completely had to wing at the time. And just straight off the back of that audition, he asked to fly me out to New York to, I guess, stage test or chemistry test with Marissa Tomei, who plays the lead in that show. So I flew over a week later and learned like 25 pages of dialogue in Italian and had this meeting with Marissa. And I remember thinking, right, if I'm going to fly to New York, I was filming something else at the time, so I'm doing this like between, like on a weekend. I think I was in New York for something like 22 hours and got back on the plane. But I thought, if I'm going to go across and attempt to get this job, then I'm just going to leave myself no room for error. So I think in terms of preparation for that, I've never prepared harder or more thoroughly because of the fact that I was having to fly across the ocean to attempt to secure this job. So that was really a lesson in preparation. Not to say that, you know, you can... You can prepare until the cows come home and you still won't get the job. But luckily, that instance was a time of, you know...
So basically, what you are saying, though, is to all those young actors out there, like dreaming of doing some of the jobs you've done, it's all about distance is how much you prepare. If it's just down the road, then you might have a little scan of it and then pop down. But if you're doing a flight, then you're all in on the preparation.
Think about it as you think of air miles. The further you have to go, the harder you prepare. And as you say, if it's next door, just quick scan, getting that.
Nothing to do with the level of job. It's all to do with the air miles.
There you go.
Devon Elliott, everyone. There you go. Ruth Young, what a truly wonderful actor you have.
There you go. Pearls of wisdom.
Put the gold medal on the boy now.
But no, what I am saying is preparation is very, very important, whether it works out or not, whether you get the job or not. If you've got time to prepare, prepare. And you know this, Graham.
But, like, you know, in fairness to you, like you say, you prepared, you went over there and you smashed it. And then, so that was that your Broadway debut?
That was my Broadway debut. So I went over there, rehearsed for a month and was part of this. And to be doing Tennessee Williams on Broadway as well, this sort of classic American playwright, was kind of terrifying, but also a bit of a dream come true. And also to play an Italian, to attempt to convince a New York audience, many of whom were Italian or are Italian, still, that I was not a Scottish actor and that I was a Sicilian. Like, that challenge and almost that trickery is something that really turns me on. And, like, as an actor, you know, being able to convince someone that you're somebody else is part of the thrill. So being allowed to play these parts that are so far away from my real self is really thrilling.
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely part of the world of acting that we all love, is like when you can really sort of push it and be someone you're completely not. I mean, that is definitely a test. You'd normally think doing a European accent in America, let's be honest, we could probably get away with this. It can be a bit cod. They won't notice. However, when it's Italian in New York, then you might as well be in Rome.
It was a real challenge. And to be acting opposite someone like Marissa, who, I mean, who's an Oscar winner and has, you know, worked alongside some of my heroes in the acting world. Again, massive challenge. And you just hope that, you know, you almost refuse to be the one who, to be the weak link. I mean, it's nightmarish to think of walking into that situation and being the one who drops the ball opposite this Oscar winner. So I think, you know, that pressure and, you know, being allowed to step into that realm forces you to do whatever you can to pull off whatever you've been asked to do. And yes, the more I say it out loud and think about it, it just reminds me of how terrifying our jobs really are. It's like, what are we doing?
Sometimes that's the thing. The worst thing that sometimes happens is, like, you know, you'll get a family member or a friend actually fully, like, detailing what you're about to do. So you're about to go on stage in front of thousands of people. And if you were to forget a word, I mean, you're like, oh, what? Yeah. Don't say that.
Yeah, terrifying. To jump back a bit to the French man who I played in Red Velvet, I remember one night in the West End at the curtain call. So we're all standing at the front of the stage and we take our collective bow. And there's this guy in the front row of the audience who looks at me and goes, "Are you French?" Like, as I'm taking my bow. And I look at him and I shake my head to say no. And he turns to his wife and goes, "I told you."
I knew that one would. I
thought, I've convinced him. He's asking me if I'm French, but actually, the whole time, I think he could have been saying to his wife, "That guy's no French." And the guy, he was Scottish, this guy. So maybe that bad review was fair enough.
That sounds like that show sounds like an absolute belter for you, a real career high.
Yeah.
A peak. It's always been downwards after that. Oh, mate.
Nice.
Did you actually, I mean, obviously that is an amazing moment. Have you had any shocking moments on stage where things have just gone completely tits up for you?
Let me think. You know, I've been thinking about that. Every time someone asks me that, I find myself going back to
No, I've got an unblemished career. When you have a gift like mine and a gold medal, things do not go wrong.
No. I've been in high school. This is pre-gold medal. So that makes sense. I've been in high school and doing this version of, like, this abridged version of Romeo and Juliet, and I got cast as Mercutio, and I came to that famous speech and that famous line, "A plague on both your houses." And I remember getting to that line as I'm being dragged off stage with like a blood bag in my shirt, as Mercutio is dying, essentially, and he's supposed to say, "A plague on both your houses." I remember forgetting that line. Wow. Just as it's been dragged off. And so instead of saying "a plague on both your houses," I remember shouting, "I have been to your houses." He's dragged off the stage in this sort of purple passage of Shakespeare. I'm screaming, "I have been to your houses," which it conveys a slightly different meaning.
Mercutio the stalker. like puts a whole new spin on him.
But with absolute conviction, "I have been to your houses." Just like, okay.
And you don't know what I've left there.
That was...
That's amazing. I love it when people... Because people, like, sometimes people go dry and they just go silent. I love it when people go bold with something completely wrong.
Especially when it's Shakespeare. Because they've got to try
Shakespeare. It's always a nightmare. I have not done much Shakespeare, and thank God I have not tried, because if I did, I would be pants. Yeah. I would just be... Yeah. Thou, thy... like, just dying on stage. Right, you know what? Let's get moving along. Like I say, you've done so many things. That's us. But theatre's done in the bin. Okay, we're going to move on. Right. Let's jump into your film career, mate, because you have done some, like, I mean, huge thing. Like, what you've been part of, it's like a dream for some people, like, you know, to be part of the Alien franchise and the Star Wars franchise. I mean, that's not bad at all. Even just like straight off the bat, you've done other films as well. But what was it like to be part of those two?
I mean, it was incredible, and I think the reason that I was given the opportunity to even audition for the films like Prometheus, films like Star Wars, Force Awakens, and even things like Game of Thrones, is because I had a casting director on my side, because it was the same casting director who cast all three of those films. And I think this so often happens, and it can be so important.
Who's the casting director? I'm just going to note this down.
It's Nina Gold.
Nina Gold, yes. Yeah. I'll give her a shout. I'm just going to email her after this.
All right. But if you've got someone like that on your team, and someone like that who's championing you as a young actor, then they have the ability to put you in front of these incredible filmmakers and possibly to sway their decisions. So I'm not saying go around and try to, you know, start getting casting directors in your back pocket and deliberately try to charm them.
Offering them money.
Right, but you charm them with your work and with your self-tapes and your auditions, hopefully. But if it hadn't been for Nina, none of those opportunities would have happened. And I think the first one was Game of Thrones, and the second one was Prometheus. And to walk on to the Alien set with sort of Ridley Scott standing there, and, you know, that ensemble of actors that they had was absolutely incredible, led by Charlize Theron, Michael Fassbender, and Idris Elba, Guy Pearce. I mean, it just, Kate Dickey, just what an incredible cast. And it felt very surreal. And you feel that pressure when you step onto a spaceship that you've seen in the original Alien films, and you're surrounded by these incredible actors. And in the middle of that is Ridley Scott, who's just a master, like, really just like a general. Like, the way he works is astounding. And it's like, although he's a director and he's like a visual cinematographer, he's also an expert in almost every field on that set. So he'll come up to you before a take and just move like a tiny little bit of your hair to the side, or like fix a button on your coat. And he just, I think he's just an absolute master. So working with these people, first and foremost, you just want to slot in, and you just want to slot into this machine and into his way of working, and you just try not to fuck that up. And secondly, you want to do a good job so that he casts you again. But I mean, people ask what it was like to be part of, and it just feels like a mad dream, because it was set in space. So we shot it in Pinewood Studios, but Ridley tends to build as much as he can. So if he can avoid using green screen, he will. So you're literally walking into sound stages that look like extraterrestrial planets or spaceships. And if you're on a spaceship and you're filming, that spaceship will be on hydraulics and will be moving as you're shooting the scene. You know, if you have an eye line, if you're looking at something and you're in close up, he will create an animation on a screen so that the actor has that to look at. So he will really... Remember, he's kept going on about strings and pulleys. Like, if he can do it for real, do it. And I think that is what makes his sets and his films so special, because they're not full of CGI, and he really prioritizes actors. So although they're these mad sci-fi movies with crazy concepts, he finds actors that are at the top of their game to carry those stories. So that was very surreal. And in terms of Star Wars, to be fair... When I've never seen a Star Wars film.
Whoa. You've not seen a Star Wars film and you get cast in a Star Wars. You'd realize how brutal that is to a lot of people listening.
I know. It really feels like it was wasted on me. I know that sounds brutal. But I've never seen a Star Wars
film. To be honest, mate, I've barely seen them myself, so I'm reacting for the public, not really for me.
You're reacting for the fans, but I'm not going to lie, I hadn't seen a film. I remember the day before I went onto my first day on that, I thought I better watch something. So I stuck on The Empire Strikes Back, and I remember, you know, I got about halfway through and thought, okay, that's enough. And then I walked in the next day, and I remember being in the car and driving into the lot and seeing Harrison Ford standing there, like, smoking a cigarette outside his trailer, and I can't even remember her name. What's her bloody name? Carrie Fisher. Carrie Fisher was there. Princess Leia. All of these, you know, very exciting, legendary actors. But if you haven't seen the films, then I'm just going in and I'm going in to do my job. But the tricky thing about Star Wars was that it's so secretive, these projects, that until you get there on the day, you haven't really seen a script. And like, if you want to read the script, they have to pick you up at your house, drive you to the studio, and allow you to read your scenes with a security guard on your shoulder, making sure that you're not filming it or taking notes. I mean, so in terms of that being conducive to good work, it's pressure and it's difficult. You know, you can't sit at home with your script, making notes on it, trying out different readings of lines, because you don't have a script. Not only don't you have a script, but the little bit of script you do get doesn't tell you where you are. So I remember walking onto that set thinking, right, I'm clearly in space. This looks like a spaceship. I'm going to play this as if I'm in some far-off galaxy. And then somebody watched the film and told me that I was just in some underground bunker. They really just don't tell you anything. But, I mean, the incredible thing about that experience was to work with J.J. Abrams, to do a scene with a robot and with an 8-foot-tall monster with six arms, and it really felt like you were in this playground being on that set. And I just think it's kind of hilarious that I've, as you say, been given these amazing sort of sci-fi opportunities, like in Prometheus and in Star Wars, but really my taste in the things that I watch is couldn't be further from those worlds.
That's brilliant. I love the fact that it's like Han Solo's there and you're just like, no idea. Is that a runner? Is that a runner? Excuse me, can you get me a coffee? No, sorry mate, I'm Han Solo. It's good though. I like the fact that they protect their scripts like that. It's very much like Coronation Street, which I've always believed Star Wars and Coronation Street to be on a par. You know, they've got to protect their scripts. Absolutely. I don't know, you will never have auditioned for Coronation Street, I don't think. I didn't get my script till they turned up on the day. It was
is that right?
Very much a secretive thing.
Mm-hmm. I hear that about
they had five lines.
Right. I've heard.
What did they think I was going to tell people with five lines?
Oh man, I've spoken as actors who work in soaps, and it is literally like a lot of the time getting the script the night before or learning your lines in the car on the way to set. And
yeah,
I mean, that's just a different skill. Yeah, different kettle of fish, being able to pull that off. And then you get there and you do one take and you move on. I think I'd struggle in that environment.
So the other film I was going to talk to you about, which is very, very different, and another like classic person to work with, which is Irvin Welsh, was Filth, which I did go and see. And you worked with Mr. McAvoy on that. How was that for you? That was a bit earlier on, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was a few years ago. And just, again, as you say, it was a dream to walk into Irvin Welsh's world. And
well, yeah, especially like, you know, people of our generation, like growing up, like favourite film, Trainspotting is never far away, you know?
Exactly, exactly. A huge part of him. I mean, who didn't have a Trainspotting poster on the wall at some point in their life? And for a Scottish film that reached a global audience, I mean, everybody knows about that film, even if the Americans needed subtitles to get through it. Everyone knows about that movie, and even though it's about heroin addicts, we're still, as Scottish people, proud that that is at least something that represents the part of the world that we're from. So to walk into an Irvin Welsh world with James McAvoy at the helm of it and John Baird as the writer and director was a dream. And I just felt very, very lucky. But I remember on the first day of rehearsal for Filth, we were shooting a bar scene, in which James McAvoy's character, Bruce Robertson, pays someone in the bar to approach my character and make out, basically accuse him of being gay, accuse him of being a homosexual. My character isn't a homosexual, but James McAvoy's character has got it in for me. So pays this guy to come up to me. So we're rehearsing this scene. And the scene becomes physical halfway through. So we're working out, like choreographing the fight. Fight, and you're getting punched in the face. So we're rehearsing this fight. And I go to swing a punch in the first rehearsal, first day on set for me, first time I met James. And I was wearing this watch that was kind of loose on my hand. And in rehearsal, I go to swing this punch at another actor. And James puts himself behind that other actor. The actor ducks, and I punch James in the face, in the nose. This is within 5 minutes of being on set. And not only did I punch him, but my watch catches his face. All of a sudden, the set just goes dead, silence. James leaves the set and starts pacing back and forwards, holding his face. I thought, what have I done? This is the end. I've broken James McAvoy's nose.
This is the end of your career.
This is the end. And because you know James, don't you? He's like the nicest man.
He's such a good bloke.
And he just sort of, you know, shook it off, patted me on the shoulder, said, don't worry about it, and cracked on. And just was the least fussy, totally forgiving person ever. So it is true what they say about James McAvoy. He is an absolute professional and a very, very nice man, because there were other...
An absolute professional who could take a punch.
Absolutely. But what a pro. Yeah, mortifying, mate. Mortifying.
Oh, I can't believe that. But I'm a bit baffled. Like, why was he so close behind him? Was it partly his fault? Or are you not allowed to say that? It was totally his fault.
He was just playing around in rehearsal. We had rehearsed it so that he was supposed to be further away. But I just thought he must have thought, I'm going to get behind this other character. And he just put himself in wrong place, wrong time.
Is that what you say about everyone you punch? Wrong place, wrong time, mate. You know, Ebon Elliott here. You know.
I wasn't solely to blame. I don't go around punching folk in rehearsal.
Is amazing.
I'm just surprised that I've still got a career.
Oh, mate, you've got more than a career. You're absolutely flying. If the rumours are correct, you're also Are you in production or about to film an M. Night Shyamalan? How do you say his name? Shyamalan?
M. Night. I think it's M. Night Shyamalan.
Shyamalan.
I think so.
You should know how to say it if this is true. If the rumors are true and you're in one of these productions, you know.
I was saying it over and over and over again right before this call. Shyamalan, Shyamalan, Shyamalan. Because it's just one of those names. It's a tricky name to remember, much like my own. But it's M. Night Shyamalan. And I can't tell you too much, but I'm literally about to fly off to the Caribbean, to the Dominican Republic, to shoot this film. What can I tell you? It's got an incredible cast. It's an ensemble piece. I mean, this is a guy who directed The Sixth Sense, for God's sake, which is the second highest grossing horror film of all time. But his thing is to like make these budget movies. So I think none of his movies are more than 12 million or something, which is, I mean, you'd be surprised, but that is on the lower end of...
No, that is budget. I know. A lot of people are going, 12 million? How about don't fly him to the Caribbean?
But, I mean, it's exciting. He makes these films on an indie budget and they become these, you know, they're marketed and their viewing figures become like studio films. And he's got so much control over his scripts and his production company that, you know, he very much has his own voice. I mean, it's quite easy to recognize a Shyamalan film. But I just feel very, very lucky. And I mean, I wish I could tell you more about the premise of the film, but it's one of the scariest, most terrifying, profound things I've ever read. And what else can I tell you? I'm just going to get the opportunity to work with. I'm working with. Have you seen the film Matilda with Danny DeVito?
I'm just leaving it. I'm leaving it here so that you'll tell me something. I'm just staying silent and letting you keep talk until you tell me exactly what the film's about.
I'll tell you who is playing, who I'll get a chance to work with. I don't know if you've seen the film Matilda, that brilliant movie with Danny DeVito and that little girl who has disappeared now. But you know that brilliant, I don't know if you've seen it, but lots of people listening will have seen Matilda. There's a character in that called Miss Honey, who plays Matilda's school teacher and kind of sneaks her library books and is very much on the protagonist's side. But I always had this massive crush on her growing up. And she was like this beautiful soul that was in this movie. And I get to work with Miss Honey, who's an actress called M. Beth Davids. She's a South African actress who, I think after Matilda, went on to be in films like Schindler's List and, you know, has played opposite Anthony Hopkins recently. So I'm getting to work with this absolute titan. And this person,
so basically what you're telling me is like, I can't tell you anything about the film apart from I'm working with someone that I've got a crush on.
Yeah, who I used to have a crush on.
Used to. Yeah, used to. Need to get that in.
But there's not much more I can tell you other than the fact that it's an ensemble piece. It's absolutely terrifying. And
it's, yeah, no, you know what, mate? That's like the end of the day. Like, all I'm saying, I'm just talking through your career here. Mm. I mean, like we say, you've been Alien franchise, Star Wars franchise, you've worked with McAvoy and an Irvin Welsh, and now you're away doing M. Night Shyamalan. I'm pretty sure he won't listen to this, so if I've offended him without saying that, I think we'll be all right.
Aye. I've been very, very lucky, mate.
What I was going to say, actually, there was really randomly, you did the Kingsman 3, didn't you? And it was totally by chance that I actually knew that, because I was doing ADR for your battalion.
Where are you?
Wow. I was like this, like, you know, anyone listening who doesn't know ADR, basically it's just filling in loads of doing voiceover to fill in all the voices at like a battle scene or whatever it is. So you have it up on the big screen, a movie that's going to be coming out soon, and you just sort of fill in more voices. So there was a Scottish battalion and they needed a Scottish voice. So I went in to do this voiceover and yourself comes Brilliant. Running across the big screen and it's like, all right, we need you. I'm like, are you kidding me? I was like, that's my bloody mate.
I mean, Matthew Vaughan, that was, again, an opportunity to work with a brilliant filmmaker and on a huge film. And my part is set in World War One, so we're in the trenches at, I think, Longcross Studios for about a week. And it's just, I'm in this sort of one pretty pivotal, and you've seen it, this one pivotal moment of the film, and I just had to kind of go on and be this intimidating sergeant major. So, you know, it's interesting. You can sometimes it's just, you know, something will come along, and even if you've just got a tiny little bit in it, like Star Wars or like Kingsman, it can be quite important, you know, no matter how small or minor the part, just to attach yourselves to directors like that and to movies like that can be really important, because they'll sit there on your CV, and at the end of the day, all of these things sort of are foundation blocks and building blocks for what your career becomes as a whole. So when these little opportunities come along to work with amazing directors like Matthew Vaughan and Kingsman, I've got to take those opportunities and try and make the most of them.
Oh, definitely. I've spoken to quite a few people who've said when they've been in Game of Thrones, no matter what their part was in Game of Thrones, mm-hmm. the fact that on their CV it says Game of Thrones, even if it's like a two-liner or whatever it may be, it makes a huge difference, especially when they audition in the States.
Absolutely. Yeah, it opens doors. And, you know, this is such a... The industry is what it is, that it can just take something like that, you know, having Game of Thrones or Star Wars or whatever it is on your CV that can give you the edge. And as you know,
having Game of Thrones, Star Wars, or Aliens, or I mean, maybe all three of these.
It's been helpful somehow, yeah.
But that, honestly, it's fantastic and well deserved, mate.
Thank you.
So, we don't have loads of time, but I tell you what, we'll squeeze in a little bit. We'll have a little chat, maybe just about some of your favourite TV stuff you've worked on. Now, you've had such a weird mix. You've had, because like I say, a lot of time you'll get someone who's just done loads of drama or whatever, but you've done, like, I mean, you've done period stuff. You've done drama, you've done comedies. Just tell us a wee bit about, like, some of your favourite programmes that you've worked in for yourself.
All right. I mean, to be honest, the most recent thing I did on telly, I don't know if you saw it, was a project called Guilt that was on, which was BBC Scotland drama. And it was the first, I think, of their fully commissioned dramas for this new BBC Scotland online network. So it was an important project. The guy who directed it, Robbie McKillop, also worked with on a project called Cleek for the BBC. So it was great to work with him again. Mark Bonner, Scottish actor, was at the helm of it with Jamie Sivis. An actress called Ruth Bradley was there. And it was the first time, because I played lots of different types of people, but it was the first time I'd been given the chance to play someone who was just a bit of a mess, and like who was full of vulnerability and actually full of goodness. I usually play goodies who are actually baddies, or baddies who are just baddies, or baddies who have a little bit of good in them. Never like the good guy.
Like, so some sort of baddie theme there, basically.
But I never get cast as like the nice guy or the sweet guy, or, you know, there's usually someone who has a bit of edge.
Some sort of bad French Italian.
Yeah.
That's usually what they like.
That's my ballpark. So I felt, and it wasn't easy for me to get this job. I mean, I had to send in, I think, three separate self tapes. And this is, bear in mind, this is for a director that I've worked with before. But I had to send tapes in to convince the producers that I could do something they hadn't seen me do, that I could be this sort of inept, private, drunken private investigator, mustachioed. at the same time. So it really took me a long time to convince them, because they saw me as this sort of either like a leading man or this sort of straight dramatic actor. So to get the opportunity to do that, I came with so many. It was so rewarding because I was getting a chance to step out of my comfort zone, to take risks that I'd never taken before, and to try and be funny. And the way that they put, I mean, Mark's such an incredible actor, as is Jamie, and Robbie's such an amazing director. Our cinematographer was so great that it just turned out, I'm so proud to be part of it. And lucky enough, after the M. Night film in the Caribbean, we're going straight into a second season of that. And honestly, apart from doing plays, there's nothing I love more than working in Scotland with Scottish crews and with Scottish actors, with a Scottish script written by a Scot, and just really getting behind that drama. And I thought Guilt almost set a new bar in terms of what Scottish television could and should be and is capable of.
It was very much on my radar, and now that you've said that, then I'll get watching it. Like I say, okay. I'll add it to the COVID list.
Add it to the COVID list. It's back on iPlayer at the moment, so there is no better time to watch it. But yeah, check it out if you get a chance.
Oh, mate, I'm on it. I will. Yeah. I will watch it definitely, 100%. And what would you say, sort of TV wise, was your sort of breakthrough on the small screen sort of thing? Mm-hmm.
I would say it would have to be a period drama that I did, again, for the BBC a wee while ago now, maybe 5-6 years ago now, called The Paradise. And it was the first time I've played the lead on television? I think it is. It's the only time I've played the lead or number one on the call sheet, whatever you want to call it, the centre of the story. And I think...
Were you number one on the call sheet, were you?
The only time, mate. The only time.
Oh, check you out.
So I had to do it, and it was a massive opportunity. And you kind of... It was the first time that I had the responsibility of carrying a show, and that ran for a couple of seasons. And I think having that opportunity opened many doors in terms of, okay, this guy's played a lead on television and carried the show in a period drama. But it was also a little bit stifling because it's period drama and you're the face of that show, people start looking at you as a period drama actor. Oh, he's the period drama guy. And you become recognisable as the guy from that period drama. So it sort of came with as many rewards and open doors as it did closed ones. So after that, it was something that I really had to renegotiate in terms of trying to turn down period drama opportunities because I was trying to veer away from that becoming that guy. But I think playing like a major supporting part, or especially playing a lead on telly, felt like a real benchmark, and it's still a show that people come up to me today and recognise me from or mention in auditions and whatnot. So they really.
I remember when I saw the trailer for it, that, and I was just like, the wee man has smashed it. I was like, honestly, mate, I was very proud as a mate to see you doing that, because I did think, and that is a phenomenal achievement. Right, well, I tell you what, mate, we are getting close to the end here. Okay. What I'll ask just one of my favourite questions before we move on to last orders, which is, what is your worst audition that you've ever had?
Okay, brace yourself. I remember auditioning for a director called Mike Lee,
who's quite a famous director, so this is a great start already.
And he's a director who's known for working in a very specific way, and that is that he improvises, he gets his actors to improvise around certain ideas, and he kind of filters those improvisations down, forms a script that way, rehearses for weeks before going into production. Like, this is just something that doesn't happen on any other set. So I'm going to this audition. Like, this guy's a hero of mine. I want to be part of whatever it is he's making, because he doesn't tell you anything at this point. So I remember going in, sitting with him, lovely man, and just sort of, you know, just chatting, chit-chatting for a wee while. Him asking me things about myself, about my family, and then he said, "Okay, I'm going to leave the room, and when I come back in, I just want you to sit there and read the newspaper. Don't acknowledge me when I come back into the room. You know, when the exercise is over, I'll say break character, and then you come out." And you come out of character and we'll talk about it. So anyway, did that, sat there, read the paper, and broke character and chatted some more. Went really well. Was in there for about an hour. He said, "Thank you very much." He walked me to the door. And there's two doors. There's like two identical doors. And I open one of them and I say, "Thank you very much." And as I'm still looking at him as I open this door, as I close the door behind me, I hear him say, "Have fun in there." What does he mean, have fun in that? I close the door and realize that I've just walked into his broom cupboard and close the door behind me. So after a couple of seconds in there, I've been absolutely devastated. Like, that went so well. I've just walked into his cupboard and closed the door behind me. I open the door and he's in stitches. And actually, I say that this is a terrible audition story because I thought I've just made a complete arse of myself, but I ended up getting offered the job. And I think if I hadn't walked into that cupboard, I'd never have got the offer. I mean, I couldn't do it in the end. But sometimes the most terrible of mistakes at least make you memorable.
That is the best. It's the best worst audition I've had. Like you say, most people's worst audition doesn't end up with them getting the job.
I know. I think some have been so bad that I've just erased them from my consciousness.
I know. A lot of people have that. I mean, we've all had those just horrible ones, but it's not gone right. But I'm glad you told me that one. I love it. Yeah, that's great. Have fun in there. All right, Eamon Elliott, that is last order. So what we're going to do is we're going to do some quick fire questions, and then once we've answered all them, we can go and get ourselves a final pint. You good with that?
Lovely. Let's do it.
All right, here we go. First up, have you got a hidden talent?
I can walk on my hands.
Really?
Yeah, for a long
time. That is very impressive. Yeah, especially at your age.
I haven't tried it in a few months, actually. There's a stretch off routine that I have to employ these days, but yes, it's still my hidden talent.
Have you got a guilty pleasure?
Yes, cookery shows, cooking shows, any cooking show.
Any cooking shows. What's your particular favourite?
I used to love Ready Steady Cook. Now I'm more of a MasterChef guy.
Do you love a bit of Ainsley?
I loved a bit of Ainsley.
All right. Have you got a pet hate?
Yeah. People who talk with a mouthful. Can't stand it.
That's not nice. Not nice at all, that one. Have you got a bad habit?
Probably staying up too late and smoking cigarettes.
Okay, I think really smoking cigarettes is the bad habit of staying up too late. That's awful.
Smoking cigarettes.
What's your go-to karaoke song?
More Than This by Roxy Music.
Hey, that's not bad at all. What a tune. Who's your favourite actor?
Joaquin Phoenix.
Well, that is a good shout. He was immense in The Joker.
My goodness.
Favourite actress?
Frances McDormand.
Another great shout. Tell you what, I don't think we've had them before on the podcast. Wonderful shouts. Your idol growing up?
Michael Jackson.
Thing is, he was mine as well, but it's so controversial now.
Let me see, because that's the truth. But cut that out. Let me see.
I'm not going to cut it out. I'll leave in the fact that I've said that as well.
Okay.
If you weren't a performer, what would you be?
A teacher.
Do you know what? There's a few people have said that.
Really?
Not that you would be a teacher, that they would be a teacher. Why do you say that?
I don't know, because it's something that I even consider now. Like, it's something that I'd really like to be part of. And I hope that the opportunity, you know, comes around. Because, I mean, you can be an actor and a teacher, right? And it just feels like a good way.
No, your career's over, mate. That's it.
Feels like the perfect way to fill that downtime as an actor, to, you know, and a great way to sort of keep your hand in the game by teaching other people, you know.
And giving back. Would you teach drama or would you teach something different? Would you teach, like, chemistry?
I'd have to teach drama. I mean, what else am I going to teach? It's my only skill.
That's the problem. If you last in the acting career too long, you've got no other abilities to go into another job.
No.
It's like,
goodness.
So it's like, what have you done? Well, I've pretended to be a hell of a lot. But what skills do you have? Not much.
All right.
Ewan, it has been absolutely brilliant having you on A Performer of Pint in a Pod. Thank you very much, mate.
It's been great. Let's meet for a proper one, proper pint, when we're allowed to, and when we come out of this extraordinary time.
So there we go. That was Ewan Elliott, a man who has punched James McAvoy in the face and spent time in Mike Lee's broom cupboard. Not to mention appearing in Star Wars, Game of Thrones, Prometheus, and is soon to star in M. Night Shyamalan's next big movie, if that's how you say it. The wee lad who nearly didn't go to drama school has done very well indeed. I'll be meeting fantastic performers in the pub over the next few weeks and months with career-defining moments and secrets from behind the scenes. So make sure and don't miss out by subscribing to A Performer, A Pint and A Pod and follow at Performer Pint on socials. I've been your host, Graham Rooney. Thank you for listening. Please do rate and review. I'd love to hear your thoughts, unless of course you don't like me, then please do keep them to yourself. And remember, no one likes a stingy mate at the pub. So, share the pod with friends and family. See you next week.